This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this Latin American edition of the program. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro gains control of the National Assembly after holding elections widely viewed as fraudulent. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The United States and many other democracies around the world, including in Europe and Latin America, have rejected the conduct and the outcome of the December 6th legislative elections. The National Assembly was the last branch of the Venezuelan government controlled by the U.S.-backed opposition. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a statement that, quote, Maduro brazenly rigged these elections in his favor through the illegal seizure of political parties' names and ballot logos, manipulation of the process by his loyalist electoral council, violence and intimidation, and other undemocratic tactics. He went on to say that the United States condemns this charade, which failed to meet any minimum standard of credibility. The Maduro regime rejects the charges of fraud. The VOA newsroom reports that pro-Maduro candidates received 60% of votes cast. This is according to Venezuela's National Electoral Council, with voter participation at just more than 30%. As in recent Venezuelan elections, there were no international monitors. The opposition boycotted the elections, which they considered a sham, in contrast to the 2015 contest when Venezuelans gave the opposition control of two-thirds of the National Assembly. The United States is one of 50 countries that does not recognize Maduro as Venezuela's legitimate leader. Washington, along with a consortium of European and Latin American democracies, support National Assembly President Juan Guaido, who claimed victory in the January 2019 presidential elections, but has not assumed office. Reuters quotes Colombian President Iván Duque as saying that the recent elections were a bid by Maduro to seize control of the body, the last bastion of opposition power. Analysts say the international community could play a decisive role in the wake of Maduro's actions. Nations will have to decide whether and how to uphold the legitimacy of the Venezuelan interim government, which derives its legality from the current National Assembly led by Juan Guaido. Regional observers argue that democracies will have to find a way to hold the authoritarian regime of Nicolas Maduro accountable and to do so in a unified manner to eventually facilitate a peaceful transfer of power. Well, with us to examine the ramifications of the Venezuelan elections, as well as the challenges facing the incoming Biden administration, are two distinguished Latin America analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society. That's an organization known as a leading voice on Western Hemisphere affairs based here in Washington. And Ryan Berg, he's research fellow specializing in Latin America at the American Enterprise Institute. And that's a policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks for having me, Carol.
You bet. Eric Farnsworth, let me start with you. I think aside from maybe Cuba, Russia, Iran, possibly China, it's fairly universally accepted that these legislative elections, you know, which give the Maduro regime control over all levers of power, were fraudulent. And of course, the opposition did boycott them, because the rules were rigged against them. The question is, now what? You know, what options does the community of democracies have to thwart this so-called fait accompli by Maduro?
Thanks, Carol. It's great to join you and all of your listeners worldwide. You do such a great job, and I appreciate the opportunity to be back with you. You know, the question you ask is the key one right off the top. What are the options available? Those options have narrowed because the Maduro regime has captured now every institution of the state and brought it fully under its control, which means that we are now dealing with a consolidated dictatorship. Any sense of democracy that Venezuela once had has now been extinguished by this fraudulent electoral process from December 6th. That's a real tragedy. Venezuela at one point was Latin America's wealthiest nation. It was also a vibrant, if imperfect, democracy, and now neither of those statements is true. At the same time, it has birthed the worst humanitarian crisis in Latin America's modern history, with almost 20% of Venezuela's entire population outside of the country as refugees, according to some estimates. So we have a collapsing society. And meanwhile, the de facto executive is working to try to further strengthen his own rule in the country. So that's the basis from which now the international community is faced with trying to determine what the next steps might be. They face a decision. Will they essentially learn to live with a consolidated dictatorship in the Western Hemisphere, or will they work together diligently and with purpose to try to find a way back to the democratic path in Venezuela? It's a real conundrum.
Well said, Eric Farnsworth, reminding us of the once rich and very strong and stable democracy that Venezuela used to be before Maduro. And now we're facing, as you say, a conundrum. Reinberg, what is your take on the options that the international community has, and will they act in a unified manner?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carol. And I agree quite a bit with what Eric said. The options were limited before the 6th December election, and now they've been constricted even further. This is a particularly enervating moment, I think, in this struggle. I would define it as a true stalemate on the domestic level. The opposition is truly exhausted, and that is something that's definitely going to further limit policy options for the incoming Biden administration as well, because many of the policy options on the table for the Biden administration and the international community do rely to a certain extent on having a vibrant opposition on the ground in the country that can keep up the pressure. And right now, Venezuela's notoriously fragmented opposition has been showing signs of fractures. It was showing signs of fractures even before the election. It seems to be doing so again now that the election is over. And so as Eric said, there's the consolidation of really a full-blown dictatorship in Venezuela with few vestiges remaining to its deep democratic past. In terms of the solutions, I mean, look, thus far, the United States has embarked on a campaign of sanctions, economic sanctions against both individuals and entities and broad sectors in Venezuela. And I think we have to understand what the purpose of those sanctions are. They're not really representative of an entire diplomatic strategy. They're more like a tactic, part of a broader diplomatic strategy comprised of tools used to promote a political transition, but also measures that are used to reduce the Maduro regime's resources to fund its repressive machinery and to contribute to these unfathomable human rights abuses that we've heard about. And I think the real challenge for the Biden administration will be linking its preference for slowly lifting some of these sanctions and coming to some sort of negotiated political agreement in exchange for some sort of return to the semblance of democracy without squandering any of that leverage. Because make no mistake, the Biden administration will be inheriting a bit of leverage in this situation, and it needs to recalibrate those sanctions if it wants to pursue negotiations with the Maduro regime. But it will be very important to improve them as a tool in a broader diplomatic strategy, while also trying to reduce some of the impact, as Eric mentioned, on Venezuela's very grave unfolding humanitarian emergency.
That's a very good point that you bring up, Ryan, the role of sanctions. So over to you, Eric Farnsworth, to talk about what sanctions are in place, and is it just the United States who has imposed them, and to what extent do they hurt ordinary Venezuelans more than they help the cause of weakening Maduro, and how can they be perhaps leveraged in the future to try to negotiate with the regime?
Yeah, sanctions are one of the tools that are being applied, certainly. And the word tool, I think that Ryan used, is exactly right, because with broad application, they're intended to be ways to build leverage to encourage the regime to change path, change course, to restore the democratic path. There are sanctions levied against any number of individuals in Venezuela, including the president and much of the leadership of the de facto regime. Some of those sanctions are for things like human rights abuses, drug trafficking, things that would be difficult to lift once they're applied. But having said that, smart people can figure out ways to use incentives for lifting sanctions or offering to trade various things for concrete steps toward democracy in Venezuela. That's a risky path, but to this point, nothing else has seemed to work in the context of getting Mr. Maduro to recognize that his time as leader of Venezuela is up. But there are other sanctions as well, particularly in the energy sector, which were levied at the beginning of the year 2019 when Juan Guaido became the interim president of Venezuela, according to Venezuela's own constitution. Constitution back about 20 years ago. And so those sanctions make it far more difficult for Venezuela to monetize its crude oil on the international economy and raise the costs considerably for their ability to do that, which obviously reduces the flow of hard currency to the regime. But we have to hasten to say that most of the destruction of Venezuela's energy sector has come at the hands of Maduro itself. The production, the output has been dramatically declining because of mismanagement, brain drain of managers who have left the country or been forced out, politicization, massive corruption to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars that should be going to the Venezuelan people that have just been, frankly, stolen by the ruling regime. So you have a real confluence of events here. The problem, Carol, to get to your question is, yeah, it does hurt the Venezuelan people. It hurts them a lot because this is the primary engine of economic well-being in Venezuela, and it's being strangled by the Maduro regime itself and by the international community, which has now made it more difficult to monetize that asset. And it's a really important asset. It's Venezuela's primary asset. But the losers here are the Venezuelan people, because the regime itself finds ways to hold on to the resources it needs for its own well-being, in fact, high living in many cases, as well as the resources necessary to keep the security forces loyal so that they will maintain the regime in control. Obviously, the people without connections to the regime are the ones who lose, and that's what has been directly responsible for the massive outflow of human beings from Venezuela into neighboring countries like Colombia, Brazil, some of the countries in the Caribbean, which frankly just don't have the capacity to absorb millions of desperate Venezuelan citizens. It's a real problem.
Back to you, Ryan Berg. Speaking of external actors, on the other side, how would you characterize the malign role of, let's say, Vladimir Putin's Russia, China, Iran, other adversaries? To what extent are they propping up the Maduro regime? And if there's any way, you know, to exploit or somehow co-opt those actors?
Yeah, that's a great question, Carol. One of the things that they've been able to do most effectively, specifically with the Russians, is help prop up some of these schemes that keep the Maduro regime and its cabal of cronies propped up as they have. So they've set up a number of schemes to flout our international sanctions architecture, to keep sanctioned Venezuelan crude oil in particular flowing to international markets with agreements that trade a sort of upfront loans for payment in kind through the Venezuelan crude later. And those are handled with a payment system that's able to skirt our regulations. And so I think the Russians in this case started their intervention in Venezuela as a very opportunistic, something that was presented to them as an opportunity. They took it. But I think now they're doubling down, using Venezuela, for example, as a platform to be able to project further power throughout the hemisphere. And so we've seen not just help in the illicit financial sector, but we've seen a number of military-to-military ties growing in the Russian case. And so I believe it was last year that there were two nuclear-capable bombers that were flown from Russia to Caracas. There's been some talk as well about arms purchases. Venezuela's purchased quite a bit of arms from Russia in the past. There's also been talk of stationing missiles, quite incendiary talk, of stationing missiles on a couple of the islands that Venezuela maintains in the Caribbean and pointing them. We can only guess where. But China and Iran are certainly active as well in the financial space, similar spaces as the Russians. And with Iran, I would say it's also growing military to military ties too. And so these external actors have allowed some of the pressure to be relieved on the Maduro regime. They've created the impression that it's perhaps not as much of a pariah state as it actually is. And they've really thrown an important, crucial lifeline to the Maduro regime as its sources of illicit finance dry up in international markets.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Council of the Americas and the America Society, and Ryan Berg, from whom you just heard, research fellow specializing in Latin America. He's with the American Enterprise Institute. And they both join me via Microsoft Teams. We are discussing the fallout from the recent Venezuelan elections that solidify for now Maduro's grip on power. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a big shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Sheha Beldin Hamid from Khartoum, Sudan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our show and our conversation about the fallout from the fraudulent Venezuelan elections. So first to you again, Eric Farnsworth, let's talk a bit more about the opposition. Ryan Berg alluded to some fissures. How would you characterize the opposition? Is Juan Guaido still popular? What are their prospects for trying to push back?
Well, I think it's a challenge. There's no question about it. I mean, you have the term of the current National Assembly ending in the beginning of January, and the whole exercise that we just went through, or the Venezuelans just went through, was designed specifically to delegitimize interim President Guaido. He wasn't allowed to run in the elections, among other things, but with his institutional base, the National Assembly now turning over, you know, that takes that away. So there's a real constitutional question as to who is the interim president. The status of Maduro has not changed. He is still somebody who has usurped the presidency based on clearly fraudulent elections from 2018, and that status has not changed. The question that would be asked is, who is the legitimate interim president? The United States has said that it will continue to recognize Juan Guaido, as have almost 60 other nations around the world. So that is going to be something that will have to be tested going forward. And yeah, there are different factions within the opposition. That's absolutely true. But the one thing that never gets discussed is the advantages that the Maduro regime has to try to divide the opposition. And the 100% effort that they have made since the last National Assembly elections in 2015 to build divisions within the opposition, to divide, to conquer, to favor certain legislators and disfavor others, to put some in prison and exile others, and frankly pay money to some, you know, others. So, you know, they have a lot of tools at their disposal to try to divide the opposition, and goodness knows they've been using them. So, yes, there are divisions, but to lay this all at the feet of the opposition, I think, is just not fair. The Maduro regime is actively trying to do whatever it can to, frankly, delegitimize and disfavor the legitimate representatives of the Venezuelan people. So I think that's where the spotlight should be shone. And once we see it in its proper light, then we come to a different conclusion.
Turning to you, Ryan Berg, for your take on the opposition and the fact that Maduro, as Eric Farnsworth said, tries to divide them purposely, but nonetheless, what about those cracks and differences? To what extent is that going to be an impediment going forward?
Well, I think it's a huge impediment to their operating together in unity and in showing the Venezuelan people that there is a legitimate alternative to the Maduro regime. I think one of the major things that has turned the Venezuelan people on the opposition in the past is when the opposition does some of the self-same things as the Maduro regime, in this case, you know, engages in occasional acts of corruption or internal fissures, as you mentioned. It just shows that they're unable to sort of operate in unison and present the Venezuelan people with a viable alternative. One thing that's quite important to note that I want to add to what Eric said was that before this election, the heads of all four major opposition parties were forced out by Maduro's Supreme Court out of leadership before the election and replaced with regime cronies. And so even though there were some members of the quote-unquote opposition who won their seats in the National Assembly, and so to the outside observer, it might appear as though there is actually a presence of opposition parties in the National Assembly, it's really anything but. And so what you have here is a National Assembly where 253 of the 277 seats are controlled by the United Socialist Party, Maduro's party, and the rest are a sort of scattering of smaller opposition parties where leaders were forced out of their leadership and replaced with collaborators for the Maduro regime.
Back to you, Eric Farnsworth. As you initially said, it's truly a conundrum, and it's going to be very difficult for incoming President-elect Biden to deal with this. He's got a lot on his plate. But what would you recommend to the Biden administration insofar as the United States is a very important player in the hemisphere and could play an important role in leading the group of democracies to try to thwart Maduro and his attempt to muscle his way in to permanent power? How do you see the challenge and the political will there, not only for Biden, but for the entire community of democracies that are still supporting the opposition?
Well, you're exactly right. And I think the first thing we have to remember is we need friends and allies on the ground in the region, particularly Brazil and Colombia, but also Guyana, the countries in the Caribbean, others that border Venezuela, as well as those others that don't perhaps immediately border the country, because they're the ones who are being most directly affected by these migration flows, which are destabilizing in and of themselves. So I think that's the first thing we have to remember. So as we're talking to countries like Colombia, for example, about bilateral issues, which undoubtedly the Biden administration will be doing, we will also be seeking their support, with Venezuelan issues. So there's definitely a balance, I think, that needs to be struck there. I think that's the first point. The second point is don't give up the leverage that currently exists. I mean, the Trump administration built an architecture of sanctions and other things to try to pressure the Maduro regime. Now, it's quite true the Maduro regime remains in power, but just dismantling sanctions, for example, just to do it, I think would be a mistake, although I hasten to say that I don't think anybody in the Biden camp is suggesting that that be done, simply to say that sanctions should be utilized as a way to get to the ultimate goal. And the ultimate goal is free and fair elections that will bring democracy back to a country that's starved for it. And then I think the other thing that the administration could do is to make sure that this is not about the United States, it's about Venezuela, and that the spotlight should be kept on Caracas and the abuses of the Maduro regime. And one way to do that is to work more closely with the International Criminal Court, which is right now trying to decide, do they allegations that the Organization of American States has come up with that accuse Venezuela, the regime, of human rights abuses and crimes against humanity. So this is a very serious charge, and it does need to be pursued. Of course, the United States is hampered somewhat in that the U.S. isn't a member of the ICC, but there are certainly ways to move forward in that forum as well. So there are things that should be considered, but at the end of the day, it's really got to be Mr. Maduro and those around him who decide that their time is up and that they really need to find a different line of work.
Over to you, Ryan Berg, for your take on how the incoming Biden administration should deal with Venezuela. And just like with Cuba, it's almost a domestic political issue because of Venezuelan refugees in Florida. So we have many, many incentives aside from the one that we all know, the importance of restoring democracy and human rights to that country. Also, I'd like you to address the role of OAS, but also, are there any outliers in Latin America with respect to Venezuela, except for, of course, Cuba? What other countries are not, you know, on board in terms of opposing Maduro's actions?
Thank you, Carol. I will add to Eric's long to-do list for the incoming Biden administration on Venezuela policy, more diplomacy. As I mentioned before, sanctions are only a tool in a broader diplomatic strategy. And so many of us who have been observing the architecture of sanctions being erected around the Venezuelan regime have always sort of wondered, sanctions and the Biden administration is going to have to fill in that blank. I think that Eric did a great job laying out some of the things that they should do. One thing that I will add to his list is more diplomacy with the European Union. The European Union, for whatever reason, has only decided to place about 20 individual sanctions on folks in and around the Maduro regime, whereas the United States has well over 200. For a union such as the EU, a bloc of countries that considers itself, just like the United States, to be a beacon of democracy concerned with the fate of human rights in the world, I think it's in the EU's interest to step up on Venezuela policy, to come closer in line with the United States, to play an integral role in finding a constructive political solution to Venezuela's crisis. I think, generally speaking, some of the fragmentation in the transatlantic relationship, quite frankly, has gotten in the way of better EU policy toward Venezuela. And so things like the Trump administration's move away from the JCPOA or the Iran deal, the Paris Climate Accords, the constant berating over defense spending, inability to endorse NATO Article 5. Some of these things, I think, have gotten in the way of the EU seeing that it has quite a common interest with the United States in Venezuela. And so I think one of the biggest opportunities for the Biden administration is to revamp EU policy toward Venezuela. In terms of our regional partners, you can look at the most recently passed OAS resolution and see some of the countries that either voted against it or abstained. The two countries that voted against it were Bolivia and Mexico, and quite a few countries abstained, six countries, I believe, countries mostly in the Caribbean who have benefited from economic development programs, mostly cheap oil, from a Chavez-era program called Petrocaribe. And so these are some of the countries where Venezuela and Venezuela issues still have a lot of importance, and these countries tend to abstain in these kinds of votes in the OAS plenary body.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to continue this conversation in the year ahead, because that's all the time we have on this Latin American edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, Vice President of the Americas Society and the Council of the Americas, and Ryan Berg, Research Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.